All right, and welcome everybody to a very special Capes and Scowls, Tapes and Scowls, Superliminal Films joint effort. I mean, everybody's here. And today we have a really fun interview for everybody. We are going to talk to Randall Lobb. Randall, how are you?
Yes, I am here.
And for those who don't know, why on earth wouldn't you know? Randall, he's behind Definitive Film. Definitive Film makes great documentaries, and we've talked about several of them on Tapes and Scowls, and it's just, he's a cool guy. So, Max, you're here.
Hi.
And Jared, you're here.
I'm here. Why am I here?
You want to know why you're here?
Yes.
Because you're our resident Muppet.
And, I really am.
And that is why you had to be here, because we're going to talk some...
I'm going to interrupt. You have your own Muppet?
Yes, we do. You should see this guy.
There's a picture on the Superliminal Films Instagram of me with a Muppet version of me, and it's hard to tell which one's which.
That's exciting.
Yeah, he is. He is basically like of all of us here who were excited to do the interview, which is all of us. Jared was the most excited because he's a huge Ninja Turtles fan and he's a huge Jim Henson fan.
Oh man!
So when he found out we were doing this, he was going very. His rods on his wrists were flailing and he was running around. It was pretty exciting.
Yeah, that was cool.
He found out that I've been in the candy store then.
That's right.
Yes.
This is going to be really good.
Well, right. If it's not at any time, you just tell us to stop. We'll hit the stop button.
Just tell us we're terrible. Idea. We'll edit it to make us
great. We ignore our audience when they tell us that, but we won't ignore you.
Oh, yeah. We're real big on telling the audience they're terrible. So, you know, we're just going to do whatever you say.
This would be the first time that's ever happened.
All right. Well, Max, why don't you ask our first question here, sir?
Yes. And you alluded to this a little bit before we started, but were you always interested in trying to have a career in film, or is this something that kind of happened upon you later in life?
Now, did you guys Google me? Is that why you asked that question? I say suspiciously.
I did do some Googling, but most of these questions I did before I Googled, then I added more.
What's a Google?
Well, so yes, I was always aiming at a career like this. Let me quickly go through a story that maybe some people have heard and is maybe interesting enough to pull out again. I used to be a high school teacher, and I was a high school teacher because I was in the film industry and I sustained a head injury. And production is very demanding, very challenging, particularly in the time period when I was in it the first time. And I couldn't sustain the career that I was thinking I was going to be on, which was I assumed, obviously, like most people, that I was going to be Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, you know, Francis Ford Coppola. We could keep going, Martin Scorsese. I just thought, yeah, that's obviously what I'm going to do. I'm going to do these big pop movies. And I went to a film school that had a lot of Czech immigrant teachers who had come across the ocean after there was a, you know, communist uprising and all kinds of trouble over there and turmoil. And these guys came to the university that I was at back in the 70s when Milos Forman came over. A lot of these guys were with sort of like his school. And or his group, his flight.
Yeah.
And the school that I went to, they were much more interested in art, and I was much more interested in pop and pop culture, particularly. I was a comic collector. I, you know, was into anything that was stereotypically 80s pop and earlier 60s, 50s, 40s. Like I was one of those kids that went deep. But after I got this head injury, I couldn't do what I expected that I would be able to do. So my wife at the time, my girlfriend, was in teaching, aiming to be a teacher. And I thought, you know what? There's nothing wrong with staying with a beautiful young woman who loves you. And she's got a career and we could live in a small town and I could live in my hometown and sort of get my bearings back because I had amnesia. And I became a teacher and I really enjoyed teaching and thought I can write my way in. So I was always in the film industry as a writer, working in development for people, and I was a freelance writer, so I'd do stuff for magazines. And very early in the days of the internet, I was writing about tech and the internet. So I sort of saw how the convergence of entertainment and technology and the internet and so on, nascent internet, were all going to come together, or my expectations were that they would come together and sort of exactly the way they did. And I'm not saying that I was smarter than anybody else. It's just there's a way of thinking about pop culture that really mapped onto the early internet very easily. And so I saw where it was going, started to work in education and the internet, and then transposed over to pop culture again about 2005-06, and we started working together, Mark Hussey and I. Mark Hussey, post-production genius, and he, you know, he probably could do a lot of the things that I could do, but it's a lot easier if you don't have to do it all yourself. So I sort of handled the writing, directing, producing. He handled the post-production supervision and all the jobs in post. And a young cinematographer came to us named Isaac Elliott Fisher, and he said, we should do something on the Turtles together. And I said, no. And then I said, oh, yes. Mark said, yes. And we started it. Now, literally 6 years of grinding on that film trained us well beyond any film school. And so we sort of, all our pop culture interests and all these different things that lined up that I sort of described on the way here, you know, these things were proven true with Turtles. And then that's how we jumped into the space heavily. We had a way to do this, if you want to call it the definitive deep dive. That's what it is now. But back then, it was just a way of approaching pop culture and a way of exploiting IP, or whatever you want to say that's the language now, that was formed years ago. And I can even theorize this deeper. This actually comes, this way of thinking comes from being the age I am, which is, I'm obviously 30 or 40, 50 years older than you guys. When I was a kid, if you wanted David Bowie material of any sort, and if you lived in a small town in rural Ontario, you can't get it. There's no access. So you either meet a group of kids and make friends with them to have access to their albums, or, you know, Cream magazines or Rolling Stones, whatever they have laying around, or you go to a used bookstore. But if you live in a small town, there's maybe one, or you have to hang around with sketchy older guys that might try and make you ride around in a Vega and hotbox you, you know, like whatever you think of, you will do to try and get whatever you like. So I just had this kind of hunter killer way of approaching, yes, Terminator reference, hunter killer way of approaching pop culture. Like, it wasn't enough to get a David Bowie album. I need to know more about Bowie and who was his wife and, you know, who's T-Rex and what does that mean? You know what I mean? You just start creating this, I don't know if it's called a pastiche or a patchwork vision of pop culture. And as you drop all these things together, and, you know, I was a little kid, I had this really, I think looking back now, precocious or an advanced way of looking at the things that I liked. And that has done me well as an adult. And I transposed easily into making documentaries because of the way my beady little brain worked.
That's fantastic. I don't think your brain's that beady.
Well, but judge after. We'll look back. We'll look back at the end.
We have a beady counter. We're going to keep tabs on it.
We'll thank give you God.
A final tally at the end.
It's amazing. It's like you guys had to geek so much harder back then. You couldn't just go on the internet and be like, "What's this?"
It's so real. That's 100% true. Like if you think about how rare it would be to see the thing that you wanted, you know, so you end up in these. I guess it's like concentric rings. Like if you loved the Conan cover, Conan Pick One, the Lancer books, the Frazetta's, those famous Frazetta covers, right. You like those, but then you might see a different cover by an artist who's copying Frazetta, and you go, hey, is that same guy? You know what I mean? You start building this way of thinking of all these people, or, you know, this Batman's not the same as that Batman, or the Star Wars comic comes out, and like, who's Howard Chaykin, the cover artist? And you know, you just start to build a way of thinking where you have to go get it. You can't just have this stuff drop on you. Nowadays, you have to turn it off. You know, your completism could go to an insane level, and maybe does for a lot of people.
Definitely does. I like the Howard Chaykin pull. That's a good one.
See, this is the problem. I'm that kid. And when that kid grows up, if you don't make documentaries, you're just a crazy guy with too many collectibles and nobody to talk to.
I'm pretty sure you're my spirit animal. I'm not sure. Well, let's dive in a little bit now, because the big thing, the big new thing for you is you just did the documentary, The Crystal Calls, Making the Dark Crystal Age of Resistance, which is airing on Netflix now. I hear it's doing really well. I love the fact that when you finish the last episode, it goes right to your documentary. I was so thrilled with your documentary. Why don't you just tell us how that came to be?
I will. I will tell you that you know, as you you make one film and the whole time you're making, so Turtle Power, the whole time you're making that film, you keep thinking, well, this is probably a fluke. And you actually get, in our case, because we're Canadian, we don't have a big full sense of ourselves, like maybe the theoretical American person is more likely to be confident and take a chance and be a risk, you know, a risk taker. And so we're Canadians. We're a little more circumspect. We're making this movie and the whole time thinking, how can we transition? So you're always playing, I don't know, platform games where in this platform we try and jump to the next one. And so once we did He-Man Doc, which is, I think, it just out right now in physical media, and it's been on Netflix for a year. There's somebody at Netflix who is a He-Man fan, Teddy Biaselli. And Ted Biaselli saw the He-Man doc and is coincidentally in our He-Man doc by fluke. And yeah, it's a weird thing. I mean, I can point out where he is. He's a big collector, and he's also a curator of all the fun geek stuff that we all love, and very serious. Like his knowledge is incredible. He's a collector and a curator of the style that he's doing things with his action figures and dioramas and lighting and photography. Like he's really into it. And he saw something in the He-Man documentary, I think, that he resonated with what we were doing. And he and I talked a few times, and some people at Netflix sort of reached out to me and said, you know, we're not real keen on He-Man, but Ted speaks highly of you. And what would you do with another franchise? And I won't say which ones I looked at, but I came up with a couple different theories of the case. And Dark Crystal was the one I think that they had in their minds. And so if I said, what about this? What about that? Somebody might have said, what about Dark Crystal? And I jumped on it because I knew that that could be one of the ones. I knew that it had elapsed over many years into different formats that didn't work. So, you know, the Gennady Tartakovsky and, you know, Louis was involved in it, and they were trying to make something at the Hub, and that was Hasbro, and Ted was actually there, and it just couldn't come together. And Henson's very careful. Lisa Henson is caretaking this incredible legacy. So, you know, she's just not going to jump into another thing and just get Dark Crystal out there. Boom Studios had some good stuff, and of course, you know, the novels, Jay Lee is in the novel space there. There's something happening all along, and it was on my radar. So I was ready to pitch it and was very quick to get something back. And the people at Netflix, I hesitate to use people's names because I don't know that they would like that. So people said yes. And what would I think about? How would I approach it? What would be my kind of my high points or whatever? I made up a document like that and ended up at some meetings, and there's Ted, and he said, this sounds like you have the right mind. So we put it together. And when I say the right mind, I don't mean my brain. I mean, like, I'm caretaking this. I'm the kind of person who is responsible to the people who will hire me. Like, if you say, hey, we're going to pick rocks today, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to your house and pick rocks because you're going to give me lemonade and an egg salad sandwich. So
yep.
I think he saw that in me and the guys that I work with as well. Like, and by the way, they're not just guys I work with. These are my partners. We are all of one mind in that way. So they opened up the gates and we had enough to get started budget-wise and approach this thing for real. So that means going to London, going on set, shooting when we could, try to get the right timing to catch some of the coolest stuff. And bam, here we are. 2 years later. That was 2 years ago now, by the way, that this all started.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So in those early meetings you were talking about, how much of the discussion ended up being about how much you could get, how much they wanted you to see, how much they did? Was there anything they were just like, we want you to stay away from this, but we really want you to focus on this area? Or were they just kind of like, whatever you want to get is fine?
No. Nobody's going to do that at the start of a project unless you've really established some imprimatur. Like, it might happen, you get six or seven movies under your belt and everybody kind of knows what you're about. In our case, I think there were some concerns, you know, don't try to tell the story of the original film. There is a documentary about that. It's beautiful. It's really engaging. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, a lot of people became Dark Crystal fans, is they didn't just see the film in 82. They saw that documentary and that, it infused their brains with, I don't know, dreams of puppetry. A lot of people became puppeteers or got into creative spaces because of that docked. So we don't want to go back and relitigate that. You don't want to open the same can again. So what we were given as an instruction was, what would you do with what we're doing now? And if you saw Turtle Power and He-Man, and we've done a couple other docs that were almost done, actually, but we are on hold, one on Conan the Barbarian. If they looked at those samples, what we were good at doing at the time, or the appearance, was taking that legacy and bridging it to something that's current. And we had a way of approaching these franchises. And they literally said, don't do that. Like, let's focus on what we have here, because it's going to be exciting and thrilling. And when you walked on the set, you realize, oh man, if we shot every day, all day, every part of production, like if we just sat there and shot everything, it would be good every day. Like you could tell a story that was hours and hours and hours long. So we didn't have to go back. You know, we could come in running and start with, here's the new one. Here's how it's going. Here's how it looks. And that was a decision that maybe at first you think, oh, we are good at joining these histories with the current material. But as soon as we, you know, got on the ground and felt what was happening over in the studio, no way, we chucked it. And I agreed entirely that they were right. But at first, I'll be honest, I thought, oh, we really want to go back.
That makes sense. And I know you guys touched on the early stuff, like right before even the title comes up, you guys pretty much covered, like, here's the original, and then it transitions right into the new one. So I thought it was a really elegant way to handle it.
Well, that's very kind. We can thank Taron Egerton for that, right? Like, when you interview Taron, the thing that you realize is, oh, he's a fan of Dark Crystal. And he wanted to say that movie inspired. Interview Simon Pegg and Natalie Dormer, the same thing. But they were three in particular who are the right age to really get that movie and to resonate. And so they did kind of harken back. But if you were going to talk to Lisa Henson, Lisa wants to talk about what's happening now because it's exciting. And oh my God, it's like her dream is coming true to some degree. I think I can say that. And, you know, we make reference to the past because, of course, there's Brian Froud. There's Toby Froud. There's Wendy Froud. There's Lisa, and there's Cheryl Henson. In the interview, you see where she's sitting at her father's desk in England. And you want to show the history. You want to recognize it. But everybody knows it, or to some degree, people know it. And so you can drift from it very quickly. Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask a boring question?
Please.
I'm a filmmaker. Well, I try to be a filmmaker when I can, but I wanted
to just have to say you are, and then you are.
Right, right. And so yeah. I wanted to know a little bit about kind of your process when you're tackling, like, okay, we have to interview all these people. We have to set up, you know, getting on, like you said, to set every day. How is your organizational process when you're looking at a job like this?
So just so you know, we didn't go on set every day. That's what I said we could have done. What we did from an organizational perspective is you look at when you can afford to go, because you have limited resources. Like, this is a world where nobody wants to pay $10 million for duck. Well, nobody I know, but if you know somebody, tell me.
I'll let you know.
You basically make your best guess. Like, I looked at what was being shot over which period of time. When do we have to submit material, you know, to let people know where we are and what's happening? When is the streaming? And you work your way backwards from there. And you just start building what would be, let's say, almost like a reverse iceberg. What's the biggest thing that we need to get early on to start to give us the charge that we need? So you need to go on set. You need to get to know people like Lisa Henson. You need to make sure that she likes what we're doing and thinks we're on the right track. You need Louis Leterrier to support you and care about you and think that you're doing a good job. You know what I mean? We need to get people at Netflix to think that we're doing the right thing. And when you start to build those, you know, tentpole assets, then you have a better sense moving forward. So it's identifying what are these key things that we have to get, either to build constituency amongst the people who are stakeholders. That, speaking of boring, there, that's a sentence you don't ever want to hear again. But you have to have people on your side. So that's step one. It would be the equivalent of seeing a gang, and you're going to take down the biggest bully in the gang. Once she's down, then you can take the rest of the gang, right? So we needed to have the biggest people in the Dark Crystal world think that we were on the right track. So that's sort of how we organized it. And moving forward, then you're also structuring based on what's available to you. You know, I'll be honest, I really wanted to interview Mark Hamill, just never came together. And so it didn't happen. But if you had said to me, as soon as I knew that he was going to be in it, I was angling, how do we get him? And it just, you just can't do it. You know, sometimes you make the best plans that you can, and then the reality of the project, snowball rolling down a hill, picking up snow, you're just part of that process.
Yeah, he was the first, when you open in that on that show, and he's the first voice that just stuck out to me. I was like, oh, is that Mark Hamill? I was so pumped.
Yeah. You know what? I feel like somebody sent me a message on Facebook. I think it might even be like just a comment on a board. We're trying to hit the social media fairly hard because people in our line of work, we have to hide. Like, it doesn't matter who we are, you know? Netflix is just trying to get this show out there, and the real stars are the real stars, like Louis and Lisa Henson and Jeff and Will and all the writers and producers, and these people put it together. And we're sort of like little bugs on the side running around at the picnic pulling crumbs out. But we don't, you need to get your profile out there because we don't want to hide. We want to say, hey, we can do this for your franchise too. So you're cognizant of social media now and trying to get your name out there. And then you attract certain kinds of attention. So someone put up this question, why didn't you get Mark Hamill? You know, believe me, I thought of it. I thought of it right away. And I'm the right age that Star Wars was, you know, ground zero for a lot of things that I like about movies. So I tried really hard to get him. And any other person I wanted to talk to, is his name Shahzad Latif, who is an actor from England who plays Clem Fandango in a really good series I like called Toast of London. I wanted to get Gugu Mbatha-Raw. I wanted to get Natalie Emmanuel. You know, there's just a ton of people that I would have loved to have talked to, but you get who you get.
Right. That makes sense. So since you're talking about the interviews, can you give us a little bit of an idea? Like, how many people did you have on crew when you handled the interview section specifically? What are your main focuses on that? Cause it looked like, and if I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong, but it looked like a couple of the interviews were green screen and a couple were practical.
None. Never green screen.
Huh. Okay. And
so I'm a big believer in situ. If you said to me, yeah, I'll do an interview with you, let's go rent the Four Seasons and we'll have a room in there, I would say, can we shoot you in your office? Can we shoot with you in your home, your guest house, your backyard, whatever? I want to catch people where they are and where they're comfortable, where they have their materials nearby. So someone could go, oh, look at this, look at that.
Makes sense.
Yeah, almost exclusively. We did shoot with some people in a soundstage, or I guess it was a recording studio. And Taron Egerton, we actually shot at a hotel where he was doing pressers all day for Rocket Man. So on his lunch hour, he sat with me for that day. Amazing. So yeah, there's no green screen, but I'm curious what you thought was green screen. I'm very interested.
It was one of, I'm trying to remember who it was specifically. There was one point I was like, it looks, because most of them you had, like you said, there was Jason Isaacs had all the mixing boards next to him. Natalie Schumer was very similar. There was one that was just, I don't think there was anything really in the foreground. And I think that's what keyed me into it. I was like, I wonder if that was on green for that.
Yeah, never. I don't like a backdrop interview, and it's just personal taste. And I basically semi-bullied Isaac Elliott Fisher, our DP and one of my partners, bullied him into it. There may be times that he would have thought, you know what, let's make it controllable or uniform backgrounds. But now he's sort of given in and agrees. I don't know that he, as a cinematographer, you want to use a background in a place anyway, you know?
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, I don't know. And I like the idea of what you said there about them being able to, especially like people on a movie like this or something, like, oh, let me grab this, or I still have this, or like you said, with Cheryl Henson at her dad's desk, like, come on, like, that's exactly where you want her to be.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, that was hair-raising, okay? That's hair-raising places. You get into some places making movies like this that you sometimes wish that you could know how it's going to feel later. Like, I don't know how else to word this. Like, at the time, you're busy. So you have to say to yourself, look where we are. Think about what we're doing. This is amazing.
Yep.
You know, you almost wish you could be the later you looking back when you're there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the funny thing. But that, to be in that office was, I mean, it's magic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jim Henson. That's his desk. We sat at it. I absorbed the psychic energy from his desk and chair. Powerful.
Yeah, no, it's wild. I mean, just think about all the decisions that were made there. It's like, man, what did this guy think of sitting at this desk?
Yeah.
Oh, it's crazy, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Power.
Cool.
It definitely comes through during the interview process, especially in some of the interstitials where you just like sweep over the desk. It just gives you that feeling of like, you know, things are still being made at the same desk, which is an incredible sensation, I'm sure.
You know, and I will jump in and say that interview with Cheryl, we used a small part of it. She went deep in second. You know how you might interview someone and you might start off, so tell me about, you know, you might start small talk.
Yeah.
She started at a level of depth talking about ley lines and mystical symbols and energy. And like as a child, she got to travel around with her, obviously with her dad, her family, and he was into it. You know, we went out to Brian Froud's place, Brian and Wendy's place in Dartmoor in England, it looks like a fairy's land. And by the way, they would say, well, of course it is fairyland. And we went to the rocks where Jim and Brian went and, you know, got inspired, and we saw the river. We actually shot, if you see any shots of a river, all those external shots, that's in the actual place where they were inspired and saw or felt they saw fairies, or maybe they did, what can I say? But she went right there right away. So there was a lot of resonance from being in that room. And because of that, you're quite astute in your recognition of being in the place, you get something intangible that infuses the conversation. That's very different than what would be a common EPK interview, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just a different feel. And so we got there in no time, like 1, 2, 3 ley lines, that kind of interview.
That's awesome.
It was awesome.
That does sound like a great segment that we should start doing, though.
1, 2, 3 ley lines.
1, 2, 3 ley lines.
Well, you just got to get a couple Stonehenges and some Avebury rings and, you know, maybe an Uffington horse or two, and you're on it.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, in your personal opinion, what was your favorite part of this project and kind of what sets it apart from the last couple that you've done?
How dare you? Which is my favorite child?
Yeah, I would have let him.
I love all my babies equally.
That's not true. I have kids.
Yeah, you're right. It's not true. Listen, I hope I'm not betraying somebody's confidence. Yeah, I'll just say it. Here we go. We did a first cut of this movie, and Louis Leterrier saw the cut, and his comments back were stunning. I can't imagine. I mean, it was stunning. He said he got everything that we had intended. And some of the wankery that you can tell that is in my head based on this conversation, like, you know, Mark Hussey, our editor, and I have spent a lot of time together. We have a lot of common language and a lot of common thought. And Isaac is younger, and he's sort of been bullied into it too. And now he's part of that. So we're thinking about metaphors and slow burns and, you know, the music here matches this feeling, and we get really granular into these, I almost want to say, metaphysical ways of looking at the documentary. And when you go on the sets, it is magic to see these 80 plus sets and to walk on them. And we're there in the evening, like everyone's gone home, and we're on the sound stages in the evening shooting, right? So we have the ability to just slow down and shoot things at this very beautiful pace. And, you know, some people, you might think someone at Netflix could say, can you cut faster? Can you make it quicker? Can you get here? You know, you think that could happen, but they didn't say that. And so we made this cut that we couldn't keep the cut the way we did it, but we had this cut that had all this sort of baked in this reverence, and we were elevating it, and we had these really kind of lofty goals. And he saw that immediately, and he, in an email, he just went down and said, you did this, you did this, you did this, you did that. And I realized somehow we had tapped into something in a space just by being on that set and being in the energy that they created. And I don't mean magic energy, just the people in the place and the family feel that they had, that the really warm, inviting space that they were creating in, and the way that he was so kind to us, we just kind of went into the same energy. And that was amazing. That feeling, or that realization, man, we were outsiders and we came in and we touched some of the same fire that they were trying to capture. And they did capture, as you saw in the series. And so I really feel like the documentary, if it matches what the director thought, and he's very demanding, rightfully so, that's amazing. That was thrilling. It meant that we were doing something right.
That's really cool to hear. It did feel like it well, it's Jim Henson. It's a family atmosphere. Every time Henson is attached to anything, I wouldn't want to be the jerk on the Henson set. I just couldn't imagine.
You're so right. That is so true. And I'm dumb enough that it didn't really hit me. Like, I went on the set and I realized, oh, okay, well, the family, you know, the Henson family. And then you go, oh, the family, Brian, Wendy, and Toby Froud. And then you go, oh, the family, Louis Leterrier, associate producer Cameron Richardson. You know what I mean? You start thinking, oh, there are lots of families here. And then they spend many, 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 many days together. And the English crews, British crews, are very, they're just very nice and polite and, you know, kind and supportive and mannered. And the puppeteers, they work so closely together. Their bodies are literally intertwined inside these bodysuits, and they're just trapped together for days and days and days and days under trying circumstances. And that family atmosphere is critical. If you did have a jerk, that jerk can't last. Like, it just wouldn't pan out. And the amount of work that you're asking of these people, like, I know you saw the documentary, you see a young puppeteer like Becky Henderson, and she, I think that's her first starring role, but she had studied under Victor Yared, who plays Hop and speaks the Podling language. Did I say everybody's names right? See, this is why I should be sitting at my computer. But so she had studied with him, right? And then Louise Gold had been with the Hensons since the Muppet Show. Like, it's just, you just keep finding these people. Kevin Clash has been there forever. So there's no avoiding the family dynamic. And in this case, it is all very positive.
That's awesome. I wanted to ask you, what did you personally geek out the most over during this production?
I did a couple of things that could only be appreciated if you were phobic about puppets. And P.S., I am. So I have a mild, it's not strong, a mild puppet phobia. I get uncanny valley very easily. Mm-hmm. So, and I have my whole life. I'm kind of creeped out by masks and homunculus. Any kind of human-like thing kind of gives me aversion. Yeah, better than phobia, aversion. And I got to watch as Ollie put on the Mystic, the Archer Mystic costume. And then I think if you see me on Facebook, it made it my profile photo. It's me standing beside him or crouched down with him. And I'm very close to this very impressive, incredibly lifelike puppet. And that was creepy and powerful and interesting. And I found it emotionally resonant. Like, I actually had feelings in that moment, and I'm not normally a very feely guy. And the same with the character Lore. Damo walked up to me with Lore and actually interacted with me as if I was acting in a scene with that character. And I think we actually shot this. We should put it out somewhere. It was emotionally powerful. And in that moment, I felt like, I get it. I get why the puppets are like this. If you have aversion, it's powerful. And if you love them, it's powerful. So you win either way.
I think that's perfectly said.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, it converted me, I'll say. It went away. Like, after we did the...
That's great.
You know, my fear. Again, not fear. That creepy feeling went away.
Right. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, just seeing, like, the Mystics behind the scenes, it made it feel more like they were just actors and not suits. It was so surreal.
Isn't it incredible?
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I was suspicious of how Lore worked until I watched the documentary. And I was like, is this CG? This feels CG, but it doesn't look CG. Like, the texture is legit and the way the light hits it. And it's like, yeah. I think it's a puppet, but I can't tell how the hell they'd put somebody in this puppet.
Isn't so, it crazy?
Yeah, mind-boggling.
I like how they...
You realize that people are... My wife said it. She watched the documentary the other night with me. She's not a huge fan of the things that, you know, probably all of us here are fans of. She's... loves musicals and reads books. You know, she's just into different things. She watched the doc and she just burst out, people are amazing. Like, how do they think of these things? How can people be so creative and so interesting and thoughtful and come up with such intricate concepts? It's just amazing.
Totally agree.
Yeah, I liked how they changed Lore. I like how you showed some of the original concept art, and I just like that they're like, well, we want it to be this way, and they just never bat an eye. They're like, well, I guess we got to do this now. We got to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. You know, I still have a question. How do you know when something is right? Isn't that a funny thing?
Yep.
I just assume, like, it never is and just keep going.
That's right. So Mark Hussey, who cut this movie and who put a lot of the feel into it, into our documentary, not the series, but he puts a lot of the feel in. He is one of those people who he would tinker and tweak forever, right? Like, he's just trying to get the color right when he's doing color balancing or whatever, just the attenuation of sound to visuals or whatever. And you just tweak and tweak and tweak. And then one day you just have to hand it in. And everybody knows that feeling. But how do you do that with iterating on a character? How does it get decided? Now Lore looks like Lore. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's pretty strange.
Yeah, it's just, I guess it's just that feeling, right? Like, it's like, and I'm sure you know this from doing the dot. Like, it's just like, can we take a couple frames off here? How about, can you add a couple more back on? Can you take, and then, like, you find, you're like, that's it. Nailed it.
Yeah, for me, I'm all gut. And I say that because I have an enormous, no, wait, that's not what I mean. I'm all gut. Like, I will go by, I guess maybe it's instincts or I believe my taste. So if we're cutting and I go, no, move that, not that. Like, I do it rightly or wrongly, I know what it is that I'm looking for. So I go with that feeling pretty much all the time. And I guess that's what it's like, that everybody just feels like this is the feeling of something being as good as it gets, and you just trust.
Yeah, no, that's it. Yeah. My editing experience, I feel the same way you do, where it's just like, I don't, something's not right. Maybe if I try this, and maybe it mm-hmm. takes a little longer, but the feeling when you get it, you're just like, ah. Got it.
Mm-hmm. To me, it's like music. It's like picture music. So, okay, here we go. We'll go deep for a second. Okay. When I was little, I used to have synesthesia. So my senses kind of got mixed up.
Okay.
Like I would hear red, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've heard about this.
Yeah, it's a known thing. I don't think it's enormously freakish or anything, but I had it for years and it was scary. I didn't like it. It's probably one of the reasons I had puppet aversion. But when I'm watching the movie in the editing room and I'm behind the editor, I'll just feel like, no, cut that, cut. And it just feels like the song doesn't go that way. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You actually feel a musical, this sounds really weird, doesn't it? But that's what it's like. Nah, the rhythm's off. And sometimes I'm standing behind the editor and I'm like swaying 1,002. That cut, you know, you get kind of a musical response to the visuals.
Absolutely.
Boy, maybe I shouldn't have said this out loud. No.
I think you need to start crediting yourself as a visual composer.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, okay. Okay. Sold.
So I wanted to ask a more personal question.
Yeah, please.
Is Simon Pegg as awesome as I hope he is?
Okay, well... I'm going to tell you a story. This is how I answer every question. So I'm sorry if this is actually a 20 question podcast and we've already done 27.
No, you're
minutes.
Good.
Yeah, no, you're good.
Simon Pegg, I'm a fan. Okay. And I'm not a fan like some people who, you know, I don't remember every episode of Spaced. I watched the series and thought it was awesome. I love the Cornettos. I like Simon Pegg in everything. I think he's really good. He's very talented and he's a lot of stuff, right? Writes, acts, he probably directs and produces. And
right.
So people like that probably are super busy and they probably don't have time for tomfoolery or, as I use the term, tomfuckery. So if somebody is going to give you their time and you are taking advantage of their stardom, their face, whatever, their kindness, you have to be minding your P's and Q's. So I guess Simon Pegg was coming to see us and it was at a studio where he was going to have to do some ADR. And when you're doing voiceover work for Dark Crystal, it's very challenging. Many, many lines and many, many takes of making that sound, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I hear that
yeah.
in my
sleep. So, yeah, very challenging. And I thought there's a significant chance that he could be coming in tired. And by the way, you have kids or I have kids, getting them ready in the morning. Doesn't matter how famous or what celebrity you are, what movie you were in, getting kids ready in the morning is tough. Getting them to school on time is tough. London is a city that's hard to travel through, and you might get to the studio for a big, busy day and then have forgotten, oh, yeah, I got to talk to these Canadian filmmakers. And what is this documentary? And is this like just an EPK? Is it going to be somebody who says, what's it like working with Louis Leterrier? And so you build a little scenario in your mind where he could come in and be short. And some people who were in the room threw logs on that fire by saying, you know, I heard that he was grumpy at another interview. And it was not somebody on my team who said that. It was someone else who was peripheral and they made this comment. They were speculating. They had no evidence, but they wondered, like, I heard that he was grumpy. Okay, fine. So I thought, I'm going to greet him as soon as he comes in. I want to make sure that I'm one of the first people he sees. And of course, he came in. When I wasn't there, I went back into the studio for a second. And when I walked out, I went by the bathroom and I bumped into him coming out of the bathroom. So I literally walked into a bonk. And he goes, oh, hey. And I said, hey, how's it going? And he said, well, I need a coffee. And then I said, well, let's get you one. Got him a coffee. And I said, early morning. And he just looked at me and he made a little face. I said, do you have kids? And he went, yes. And in that moment, we were two people with common interests, common ideas. We both have kids. We know what it's like to get them ready in the morning. We went into the place that we're going to do the interview, which is an ADR booth or, you know, full room, mixing room. And my wife was there and the other people that are in the room and the crew. And there's cookies sitting there. And it was just a warm, inviting scenario. And he sat down and had a coffee and a couple cookies. And we just chatted for a while. And that warmed everybody up. And by the way, he was never grumpy once. It was an amazing interview. He was super smart, super thoughtful. He was a great guy. And then he invited us in to the record session, which we thought wouldn't happen. So there you go. Awesome. He was awesome.
That's great.
Yeah, I really enjoyed watching him do that. Even making that noise that I still hear in my sleep.
It was cool to see how much he moved with the puppet while he did the voice work. Really cool.
Yeah, he's the real deal. He's a great guy. He's really smart. By the way, Natalie Dormer, same story. Really smart. Really good interview. Really thoughtful. Really good person. Really kind. Didn't have to be as nice as she was. She's the first thing in the morning. You know what I mean? Just really, really great. And then, of course, Taron Egerton, guess what? Super nice. Came in on his lunch. Talked to us. Was enthusiastic. Wanted to be there. Wanted to talk about it. Like, I can't speak highly enough. Jason Isaacs, you saw that interview. Just everybody was ready to be part of this that was in. Nobody was a tough interview.
Yeah, it seemed like everyone was accepting of the family atmosphere and everyone wanted to be there for every bit of it. And like, especially the younger actors, they were definitely soaking it in because they get to work on something so significant to who they are that you can, it definitely comes through on the interviews, which was fantastic.
And by the way, just to name the person who most would have been annoyed, if anybody, it would have been Louis Leterrier. Remember, he is doing 10 episodes. He's operating his own camera. You saw the doc. It's what, 70 pounds? It's probably 2 hours. He's there 2 hours before he starts shooting. So he's doing work in the morning and he's probably there 3 or 4 hours after we're done or he's done at the end of the day. And he said to Isaac, I'm not going to do, you know, a sit down with you. And Isaac's like, what? And he goes, I want you to be with me. So Isaac is literally beside Louis, shoulder to shoulder. Isaac's in the pit, like total access, opened the entire production to us. Go where you want. Do what you want. Be right in the space. Just don't be in the shot.
That's awesome.
Like, it is amazing. I can't imagine another director opening up like that to us. Like, literally, here, there, shoot everything I'm doing. Let's do that. And so we'd stop thinking about getting an interview with them. Like, after that, you're like, I don't know. This is way better. Way better.
Yeah, what are you going to ask him that he hasn't shown you already?
That's right. He let us see it firsthand. So it's way better than having him go, yeah, I want to operate my own camera. No, no, no. Let's see him operate his own camera. Like, it was apparent right away. This is the documentary. We're sitting on a gold mine. Anyway, that's all because he's a super kind, supportive.
That's awesome.
Amazing.
All right. So I think we've definitely covered the Crystal Calls. We want to also ask you a couple questions.
Please.
How soon will Riddle of Steel be viewable? Is it already out or is it like...
Sure, you haven't done enough work yet. We want more.
Well, you mentioned that you were like 80% done while you were filming this, and obviously, you know, this had to be ready at the same time as the show. So, you know, we're all like waiting for the next thing because we've been such big fans of what you've done so far. So we're just like consuming
very
more.
Kind. So listen, here's the story: a crystal crack. When it started 2 years ago, I was already 80% done. A Riddle of Steel. We were sitting on basically a 5-hour cut. And that 5-hour cut, part of our process is we do this really big pre-select cut. And then I go in and cut it down with Isaac. Isaac and I do these particular things that we have a little process before it gets to Mark. And Isaac and I went in and did that. And we know exactly what we need to finish this film. Basically, it's from Austria and it's made of oak. And it kind of talks something, you know, like kind of, yeah, like that. And so once we get him, we literally have a documentary. So why didn't we get him? Well, do you remember there was a Conan movie in production or in development at Universal?
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't pan out. And then there was talk of a Conan series. And that was, I believe, in the news. It was at Amazon. And then that didn't pan out. Well, if you were working with the people who owned the Conan franchise and you kept thinking something was going to happen with Conan that would raise the profile of your documentary, and if the people who were working on Conan thought that maybe your documentary would be a good way to introduce people back to Conan before the release of something new, you would not release your documentary yet.
Yeah.
So strategically, we need to hold on to it. You can't not have Arnold. We have to have Arnold. And I also, to be honest, want to do something a little more about Basil Poledouris's score. But yeah, we have, I mean, we spent a day with John Milius. We have that. We have so much stuff. We have such we are really happy with that doc. We just have to get Arnold. And by the way, after we shot, Marvel rebooted Conan very successfully. After we shot, Funcom has the game. You know what I mean? Like, there's stuff that's happening, Conan, that I should be talking about. So, you know, I say 80. Maybe it's down to 70 because these other things are really interesting. Like, Jason Aaron's Conan is great. Jerry Duggan's Conan is great, right?
Yes,
right.
Both of
really,
those books.
Really good.
So good. Jason Aaron's been red hot.
I keep waiting for people like Jason Aaron's and Donnie Cates to be called in to write something in the franchises they're working on, right? Like, you would think somebody would call Jason in and go, hey, we're trying to do a Conan series. Like, he seems to have it nailed, don't you think?
Yep.
You would hope, yeah. Every now and then you'll see some of these comic writers on different shows, TV and movies, but...
Tom King to The Office, please.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like, listen, if Ava DuVernay is listening to this podcast, New Gods documentary, Kirby goodness, I'm ready. I'm ready.
Good call.
You know, you want Funky Flashman? You want that story? Let's do it. Let's talk about it.
That's awesome.
Oh, just wait. This is a comics podcast, right?
Yep, we do.
You guys know everything I'm talking about right now.
We do.
We do, yeah.
Oh, this is... I feel so at home right now.
Yeah, yeah.
We're nodding along, but we actually know what you're talking
about. We're smiling a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you... Listen, can you imagine if if I could do a New Gods, could you imagine... Like, this is one of those things where... There's a lot of young people that don't know enough about Jack Kirby and why is he important. And there's lots of people that don't like his art. It's chunky. It's weird. The faces look funny. And then you want to teach them. No. You don't understand. This guy invented comic panels. You know, you want to tell these stories.
Are you planning on staying in the world of documentary going forward? Or do you want to work on more scripted material as well?
Yes. And yes.
Nice.
You know what? I started in the industry as a writer, and I won't say I'm a great writer because anyone who writes is wrestling the same problem, which is to say, you probably think you suck.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that I've written that I think would be fun to do, and we've looked at them. I mean, we have a horror documentary that was very close to happening somewhere and it fell apart, and we're trying to go out with that right now. And if we do this horror, it's a real life horror documentary. If we get in that space, that could be the jump off to do some genre stuff, some horror feature stuff. But I mean, I don't think anybody right now is going to look at the work that we've done in docs and immediately transpose it to scripted.
Right.
Maybe they will. Maybe they think of other filmmakers who have done that and we could name a few. And some of them are coming out with good stuff right now. But in my case, I'll do whatever works. Like, if you want to see another doc, if you have a big IP and we sit down and figure out a way to do it, we would do that until the end of time, happily. If somebody likes one of the things we've got sitting in the hopper, a piece of writing, I mean, we could easily... The same people that shoot something nice in a doc, could they shoot something nice in a scripted? Yeah, they could. Isaac's very talented.
Yeah, once you said a real life horror documentary, you got me thinking about The Nightmare. Did you see that? About the
what if I told you that I saw it and I wasn't nearly as scared as I thought I would be, and I immediately started saying to people, you know, I got a story that I think is scarier than Nightmare.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I do. And we have it all ready to go. It's just a matter of finding the right home for it.
Oh man,
our teaser is scary.
Oh, you got me super excited. That's right up my alley.
Oh man, I'm tempted to send you a teaser off camera.
Oh.
We've got footage of some really creepy stuff. And by the way, I'm not a believer. I'm not coming at this from a perspective of I believe in ghosts and we have one on camera. It's nothing like that, but it is just, it's like Nightmare. It's true life horror where we won't have to do a whole lot of extra stuff to scare you because the reality is unbelievable.
That's so exciting.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
I love how excited you have Max right now.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Now he's the kid in the candy store.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I should tell you, Dark Crystal and Henson fan, we did shoot in the workshop. We shot in the Creatures Workshop.
There. Oh, yeah. I saw the molds and everything. Yeah. Oh,
right. And that guy that, you remember the guy with the leather John who had the head open with the tray and the audio animatronic, the animatronics inside?
Right. Yeah.
That guy works in the Creature Shop, and he made a comment that you'll understand. He said, it's hard for me to go to sleep at night because I'm so excited to get up in the morning and come back to work.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. he loves it. And there are people in that shop at Henson's. They literally jump out of bed in the morning and race to work. Like, they're so excited and they're so disappointed at the end of the day when they have to go home. It's just, it's such a place for people who, they're lifers. Like, they are in it, you know, for real.
I know.
So I get it. And the same for horror buffs, right? Like, if you're into it, it's not work at all if you're into it.
No, I went to school for special effects. So when you guys were doing all the stuff in the creature shop, I was just like, oh, my God, look at the mold. Look at these core molds. These core molds have so much detail.
Yeah.
Isn't it crazy?
Oh, my God. Yeah, yeah. I was freaking
really,
out.
Really, really good. Isaac is like you. He is a sucker for all the practical stuff. So he was going bananas.
Yeah. I could appreciate, I would be going bananas too.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know a few years back they had the competition, the reality show where they had them working in Jim Henson's Creature Shop, and the winner of it got a contract with them.
I know.
Yeah, they had all the contestants working there, and that was always so much fun to see. So
it's wild.
It's amazing. Yeah, amazing.
It's so cool. I wanted to ask you about, since, you know, I mean, we are kind of, I'm an aspiring filmmaker. Jared does stuff with me. Tim is tangentially related to that. What advice do you have for people who want to start trying to do documentary film? What would be something you wish you knew when you started?
Well, you can't do it by yourself. So the thing that is most critical is to create a workflow where you have teammates you trust all the way down. I probably, left to my own devices, would still be in my basement writing screenplays that nobody would ever see and collecting things that don't get shot by a talented cinematographer. Like, I need Isaac Elliott Fisher. I need Mark Hussey. I need Manny Hussey, who worked with us. I need Matt Hussey, who did the composing of the soundtrack, which I really love. It's just, you have to build a team that works as one. And the second thing that I think most filmmakers need to remember is, it's not about us. Your ego is best left at home. Maybe not even at home. Leave it outside in the backyard, because your wife doesn't want you to have it either. But best idea wins. And whoever's able to most articulate their point deserves to be that best idea. So for me, what that means is, if I'm going to be a director and I'm going to be sort of like the, what do you want to call, gatekeeping producer, I have to be the most articulate in the expression of my vision, so that everybody can say, right, we want to do the thing that you're suggesting. So there you go. Get your team, have your team care about the same things, get your ego out of the way. Be super articulate and know why you're doing what you're doing. All your choices, in my estimation, need to be explained. And if you can do that, then the people that are working with you will go either, no, 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 here's my point. And then you're a big person who listens and goes, okay, fine. I'm man or woman enough to listen and change my tune. So those are three I would point out. But the fourth thing maybe is to just do it. Go out and fail as hard as you can and just keep going. I have I don't know if it's a truism. Is it a motto? We say, eat the sandwich. So years ago, we were leaving Paramount. We had a meeting at Paramount. It looked like nobody wanted to buy the Turtle Power documentary. And Mark Hussey and I were driving from Los Angeles back to Las Vegas to fly home. Don't ask why we drove back to Las Vegas to fly. But we're driving back to Vegas. And we said, maybe this is the good part, that we did this, like the doing of it. You know what I mean?
Right.
This is the thing that we're doing. If you're always waiting to do something, if you're always saying, well, I can do that if I get this, or if I do that, then I can do the next thing. If you're always building conditions that you have to meet before you can do the thing you want to do, you'll die and it'll be over. So you have to say, this is the day I'm alive. This is the day I'm going to do it. Wow.
That's...
went deep there. Sorry, guys.
No, I think that was great.
That was... very,
it's true, though.
Very
it really awesome. Is. Really.
So I
we'll get it.
I want to ask you something. I want to ask you if you could do a documentary on any IP with
David Bowie.
Okay.
Good answer.
I can't tell you how much I love David Bowie. And I don't mean that I'm the biggest Bowie collector. I don't know all the songs. I don't have all the albums. You know what I mean? It's not about that. Is there anybody more enigmatic and interesting? I mean, I would love to do David Bowie. I would love, there's one I can't, no, I will say, I would love to do Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, that'd be cool.
And I have been trying to do it for a long time. Desperate. I would give my left baby toe to do Spider-Man. I've collected the X-Men since 1970. So there, that's a handful.
That
if somebody could allow me to get Wolverine,
a documentary on Wolverine. Like, I've interviewed Len Wein. I've interviewed Jerry Conway. That's Punisher. You know, like, there's stuff that I would like to talk about from 74, 75, you know, ASM 129, Hulk 181. I want to talk about these critical comics and the, you know, the worlds around those characters. Yeah, basically, I just said everything.
That's a good answer, though, right?
Uh-huh.
If you need a documentary about something, you're the man to go to.
Just anything. Just, yes. Say, we need someone to do a documentary on Tim Hortons in Canada. I'm in. I'm your guy.
I would watch that, so.
You know, the truth is, I was not a fan of the Turtles. I was not a fan of He-Man. I was not a fan of Dark Crystal. I liked it. What makes me a fan is the process. So I think I'm a fan of process, and I'm a fan of finding out. So I now love the Dark Crystal. I think it's awesome. But my way of loving it isn't to watch the show. It's to immerse myself in the world of it and try and do something in that space to add and to get other people to care about it the same way. So it's a different kind of thing, right? It's a, yeah, it's a process thing. I'm a sucker for that. Let me in and I'll start figuring out how you bake that pie. And now I'm a fan of you and your pie.
Nice. That's awesome. We'll get Kevin Smith on the Tim Hortons documentary. I'm sure he'd do it.
You know, I've tried to interview him many times. I've tried to line it up. And now here he is rebooting He-Man now?
Yeah.
What are you thinking, Kevin Smith? Rude. By the way, it's not that I'm a huge fan of his per se. It's that he's so articulate about everything. Like, he cares so much and seems to have a take on everything. What a crazy... It's amazing to interview someone like that who just seems to have an answer for why this, you know, whatever. Like, why do you like that? What do you care about? And he's always got the answer. It's interesting.
Agreed.
All right. Well, any last things you want to tell our audience and maybe plug where they can find you online and Definitive Films?
If you look for me, I am often called the lab coat guy. And by the way, that is why there's a true horror documentary out there. It's about that character, the lab coat guy. So I am at the lab coat guy on Twitter and at the lab coat guy on Instagram. We're also Definitive_Film on Instagram. And we have a flourishing little Facebook group going under Definitive Film. And we're trying to get people to come over and see what's up so we can put out some behind the scenes stuff. And if I'm not mistaken, we'll soon have a comics oriented podcast with video, a video podcast where we tell some of the stories of the comic artists and people we've met and worked with and get some of the behind the scenes that we can never show, you know? So.
Cool.
You know, if we got to spend some time with Tim Truman or Mark Schultz or Boris Vallejo or, you know, you name it. If we got to spend some time with those people, there's a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor. We're thinking of getting that out. And if we do that, it will be probably under our Definitive Film.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Can't wait for that.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope so. I said it out loud. Now I can't not do it.
Right.
Yep. I'm telling everybody.
Oh, man. Oh, I'm scared. Cut it out.
Thanks so much for doing this. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. You're very patient. I'm a bloviator, so it does tend to can be the opposite of a dialogue, more like a monologue, right?
No, it's exciting. I mean, I was excited listening to you talk, so I'm hoping the audience is too. But it was
great. Don't ask them, please. Let's keep in the fantasy that we've created right now.
We'll just tell them they're wrong if they say anything negative.
They are
negative.
Wrong. We don't care about them.
Oh, good. You're right. Oh, they loved it then. Thank you, audience, for loving this. Awesome.
See, now you're getting it.
Yeah.
And they would love to have you back anytime. When you have a new project ready, you just let us know.
Yeah, or if you're just bored and you want to just talk comic nonsense, we're around.
I do that daily. Just call me anytime. You'll hear it happen. It happens live.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks,
Randall,
guys.
Randall Love, everybody.
Woo! Woo!